I'm Dr. David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences.
I am Dr. Christopher Chauncey Watson, Global Marketing Director at Gilead Sciences.
Welcome to Zero Hour, a podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences, where we will be speaking with leading health and culture experts to understand the barriers that keep global populations from meaningful, transformative care. We'll shed light on inequities, we'll celebrate innovation, and together, we'll imagine a world with zero barriers, zero disparities, zero new infections, and zero people left behind. It's possible, but there's zero time to wait. Have you ever struggled to order a cup of coffee when traveling in a country where you don't speak the language? It's stressful, right? Maybe you pointed at certain ingredients or even pantomimed. And if you didn't end up with what you wanted, hey, at least the stakes were fairly low. After all, it's just coffee. But what if, instead of struggling to order a latte, you were struggling to communicate with a doctor about the medication you needed to get better? And even if you managed to communicate with that doctor, you were worried that they were going to judge you. That stigma or ignorance would keep them from helping you. For so many Latinx people, both in the United States and across Latin America, that situation is a reality. They struggle to access care and face HIV discrimination, not just in medical facilities, but in their own homes.
Today, our guest is Jose Romero, who is a community organizer living with HIV, who is committed to transformative justice and wellness in Black, Indigenous, people of color, and two-spirited LGBTQ plus individuals. They have helped community organizations across the U.S. and Mexico and provided gender-affirming Spanish interpretation for clients around the globe. Jose is Director of Community Advocacy, Research, and Education at the Proud Foundation. Oliver Ranch is a Business Development Director at Charities AIDS Foundation America. He has more than 15 years of experience, ranging from grassroots activism, not-for-profit, and government sectors. His agencies have included work at the Global Activist Network, United Nations Development Program, political campaigns in Latin America, the Human Rights Foundation, and the Oslo Freedom Forum. Jose, let's start with you. Tell us your story.
So my name is Jose. I use they and them pronouns, or ella and les in Espanol. I am non-binary. I am queer. And I have been living with HIV for over 8 years. And I was born in the United States in a small town, without a hospital, without a clinic, without a doctor. I was born into a family that didn't speak English, so Spanish was my first language. And I was the first in my family to actually be fluent in English. So I would often be interpreting and translating for my parents, even as a child. And early on, those experiences, seeing what my parents were going through, what my sisters were going through to be able to access care, really taught me about what is necessary to actually build healing, that we actually have to care about each other and understand each other. And so now I do language justice work in the HIV space. And language justice pairs interpretation and translation with relationship building, with equity work, because we know that just because something is available doesn't mean that it's accessible. And that's what language justice is about making healthcare more accessible, right? Not just more available. For me, in the context of the HIV and AIDS spaces, it's looked like translating materials for people who are living with HIV, reading their prescription bottles to them so that they don't confuse once a day with 11 times a day, because once in Spanish means 11. It looks like creating training opportunities for people living with HIV to actually become the caretakers in the work. And it looks like being able to develop language that helps all of us be healthy together.
Why are you so passionate about this work?
Because my first language was Spanish, I want us to be seen as the solution, that people living with HIV who don't speak English are actually a part of the solution. And for me, this passion really comes from my mentors who taught me that being able to communicate with other people is how you're able to form relationships. It's how you're able to make sure that people will come back to those medical appointments. Because if you don't like your doctor, if you don't know what they're saying, you're not going to go back to the hospital.
I grew up in the South United States. And again, language is such a critical factor. And when we really start to look at how do we access healthcare, that has become really one of the critical components to my family even receiving the care. Why is language justice important to improving access for HIV care for Latinx communities?
So, you know, there are over 1.2 million people living with HIV in the United States. We would be one of the biggest cities. We would be able to change any federal election. But one of the reasons that we're not able to do that is because we as a community are not able to come together because of a lack of language resources, a lack of other resources for us to actually have that kind of relationship building.
Jose, can you give us an example of how language can stigmatize and cause harm?
In Spanish, there are certain words that actually are specifically created to stigmatize people living with HIV. For example, there's this word called sidoso, right? And it doesn't really translate into English very well. But it basically means somebody who's toxic because they are living with HIV. So we have these kinds of already ingrained forms of stigma within our community. And then when we come to the United States, particularly in the South, where I've been doing so much of my work, right, we then experience HIV criminalization. We experience stigma for being members of the immigrant community. And so those things shape how we are able to approach healthcare. And I've had so many experiences with the people that I work with where they'll go to the doctor, and if the doctor isn't trained to be responsive to people living with HIV, we'll tell them like, hey, maybe you shouldn't come back. Actually, we'll discourage them from coming, or maybe you should go look for healthcare somewhere else. And especially if you don't speak English, there are hospitals and clinics where they'll say, you have to bring your own interpreter and translator. We don't have the money for that. So what do? We're abandoning a section of our community. And that's just not right.
What could medical systems be doing better?
I recently heard that at the current medical school graduation rate, it would take over 100 years to be able to meet the need of the Spanish-speaking and multilingual community in the United States, because there are so few medical professionals that graduate that are multilingual. And so we actually need more opportunities for medical professionals to be able to learn other languages, to get incentivized to do that work, but also that relationship building piece, right? That's why it's called language justice. It's not just interpretation and translation, it's relationship building.
But what do you think are the biggest challenges to the Latinx community, particularly in the US?
As we're speaking right now, there are people in immigration detention centers who have not been found guilty of any crime, who are not able to access HIV medical care. I can think of Johanna Medina, who was somebody living with HIV, who was denied HIV care while she was in a detention center, and then died from AIDS-related complications. So that's just one very specific example. But on a broader scale, the Latinx community, particularly in the South, is facing barriers around transportation. Hospitals are closing in this economy, and so folks have to go farther for care. And if you don't have a license because you are an immigrant and you haven't been able to get citizenship yet, you might not actually be able to drive that hour, those 2 hours, to be able to make it to the hospital, right? So you get scared. So there's fear, there's stigma, and people don't want to talk about it because they're also worried that they're going to get deported.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own HIV diagnosis experience?
So I've actually only ever had one Latina doctor. And he was the first doctor who gave me a test for HIV. I went in and I was sick, but he was Catholic, and he made sure to tell me that he was Catholic because he asked me, you know, if I had had sex with the man. And I said, yes. And he instantly left the room. I was like, oh, okay, I'm not sure what's happening. And he came back and brought somebody else who they started talking to me about other ways that I could be safer, which meant not having sex that was gay, that was queer. Meanwhile, I was just there for a test. So that experience left me very afraid to go back. And when I got a call from him later on, because he didn't invite me back into the hospital in person, he said, you know, your test results came back and you're HIV positive. You should probably get that checked. And he hung up on me.
He said this to you over the phone.
He said this to me over the phone. I was out in public and I just, fortunately, I was with a friend and she really held me down and we were able to make some peace with it in that moment. And I was then able to find a doctor who was actually affirming. But that experience made me afraid to talk about my own diagnosis. And now I do language justice work. I went from being so scared to even talk about my own diagnosis to helping other people living with HIV share about theirs.
Jose, you've used the word Latin A. Walk me through. What does that mean?
So whether it's Latine or Latinx, which are when you put an E or an X at the end of certain words in Spanish, this is part of the work to make our language more inclusive and empathetic. You can have a room of 99 Latinas, ends with A-S, and one Latino, O-S, walks in and it becomes a room of 100 Latinos. That does not accurately describe who is in that space. So as interpreters and translators who are working in medical spaces, we have to do the best we can to be able to practice inclusivity. And so we've made the decision to change our language to reflect that. And so in the interpretation and translation networks that I'm a part of, we have lately been using the word Latine.
Hello, Oliver. How are you?
Doing great.
How did you start this work in human rights and activism?
At a young age, I understood that what I wanted to dedicate my life to was helping others. I got into this work just because I wanted to make a difference in my community, local community. And then I saw that the local community has the same challenges as most Latin Americans do. People in the street that just need someone to come up to them and talk to them and see what's going on with their lives and just offer a little bit of empathy. That got me into studying politics.
Talk to us about your work globally in activism.
Sure. I worked for the Human Rights Foundation after working at the United Nations Development Program. And both of these works involve a lot of activism. So I got to meet worldwide activists that mostly work with human rights issues around migration, female genital mutilation, rape, a lot of sexual activism because, you know, women mostly get, and the minorities get a really hard time on what their sexual preferences are, what their sexual activities are. So I've been working mostly in Africa and Latin America because this is where we have the largest migrations right now, Syria and Venezuela. And in both cases, I was really interested in seeing the migrants that were arriving in Europe or were arriving into countries that have adequate care or testing were just finding out once they got there that they were either HIV positive or they had an STD or anything like that. And I started to try to figure out what the correlation of the white war-torn countries or authoritarian regimes and how you're already fleeing persecution and what you have to go through and health-wise to keep yourself alive was just mind-boggling to me because you have the UN system supporting everyone, UNHCR, the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations. You have these people operating everywhere. But even so, they can't get everyone tested because a lot of people, you know, reject getting tested or they because what we talked about religion or their personal beliefs or anything like that. You know, Venezuela, for me, and Cuba especially, are my soft points around Latin America. And it's mostly because of the governments that ignore homosexuality, ignore the public care healthcare system, or just defund it completely because they just think that providing healthcare for a population that for them it's not worth it. I grew up in Ecuador. I'm half German, half Ecuadorian. And I would see
always outside of these like gorgeous churches that are like so much money spent on them and people donating money. But outside you had all these homeless people waiting and people that are just, you know, either maimed or had were sick or with kids. They came a lot from like the rural areas of the country to just be able to beg. And it just seemed so unfair to me. I just got a big passion for injustice. I studied here in the United States, foreign affairs. And then I went into politics because I always thought, you know, politics is a way to change things from the ground up. And my German grandfather, who lived through the Second World War and was a prisoner of war, he always said, listen, never go and try to change things by force or the military. Do it through politics. You need public policy in order to help people. After that, human rights, which just lit an incredible passion inside me. You know, it's my favorite thing to do, helping other people achieve their dreams and also equality and in a more egalitarian world.
I used to date someone who was a policymaker, and we would often argue as a researcher myself, was it research that begets policy or does policy beget research? But you have such a vast experience. What did you learn from that experience?
It seems that people ignoring the truth, people just not wanting to deal with hard truths like HIV infections. And you can see basically how most of authoritarian regimes or like conservative pundits or politicians, wherever they are in charge, the HIV rates and STD rates, they're just like skyrocket through the roof. We support a lot of like local medical providers that are helping all these migrants and refugees get tested, get medicine. Most of these people don't even have money for a bus or any type of like motorized transportation, and they're walking. So they walk for like months to just like leave Venezuela, or like they go on boats to leave Cuba or anywhere they can. It's not easy to get like a work permit or your citizenship to be able to access work. But most of these people go into sexual work. And once they go into sexual work, it might not be that they're even part of the LGBTI community. They might be straight, or there might be women who are cisgender. They go into sexual work just to make ends meet, and they don't know that they have HIV or that they have any other type of STDs. We see like Colombia now has a huge increase in HIV infections just because of the mass migrations that's happening from authoritarian regimes like Venezuela.
Can you speak a little bit about the role of religion and how it weaves into these conversations around HIV for Latin communities?
I would say it starts with not even the HIV conversation. It starts just about being queer or part of the LGBTI community. My first boyfriend, or the person that I was, you know, kind of dating when I first started exploring my sexuality, when his parents found out that he was gay, they just immediately might send some people from like a conversion therapy center to kidnap him and put him in conversion therapy for over 5 months. I had to sue his parents because all of society, including my parents and the parents of my friends who were the lawyers who could have helped you or whatever, everybody refused to help me because they're all very Catholic, very religious. It's a sin for them. And, you know, just getting in any way involved and LGBT issues was a big no-no in their societal structure, or in you know, their local churches. Having the church not even accept us or talk about it or keep labeling this as a sin, you know, a lot of these churches, and especially evangelical churches in Brazil, in Texas, they offer alternative treatments or that don't involve science-based, you know, facts or science-based medicine. And then after that, they also, they stigmatize you more because they also think like, well, this is your punishment for not following God's law or not following what I told you in church or in mass. So that just like increases, that stigma increases the sense of not wanting to get tested. What am I going to do if I'm HIV positive? I've already sinned. I'm going to go to hell. So this just increases a personal inconsistencies of trying to take care of your health. If I'm only a top, I won't get it. It's only like a bottoms. You know, it's always these misinformations that are making the pandemic grow and not actually find solutions where, and I think education and this type of conversations are the ones that need to happen to let people know that the more you know, the more you get educated about it, and the more you take charge of your own health, the better you're going to be. Like, I did have a lot of these misconceptions before, too, that you're safer sleeping with someone that has HIV and knows that has it and is taking retroviral medicine than someone that is not even testing themselves. People who are getting tested and HIV tested, and you have to go through your program every 3 months to get tested, to get either pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP, or your retrovirals, you're always aware of what's going on with you.
So we're going to go to our good doctor, our clinical doctor, Dr. David U equals U. Can you describe that for me?
Sure. So U equals U is undetectable, is untransmittable. And that essentially means that if you're a person living with HIV and you're on your HIV medications or your retrovirals, antiretrovirals, like Oliver said, and you reach an undetectable level of the virus in your bloodstream, which is defined as less than 200 copies when they do the blood test, you not only get that at one point in time, but you sustain that over 6 months. That's what's called U equals U. And why it's so important, like Oliver was saying, was what that means is that in multiple studies, they found following couples along, and these are gay couples, straight couples, who are not using condoms and engaging in condomless acts, there's zero cases of transmission between a person who's living with HIV and their partner who may be HIV negative at the time. So that's what U equals U is, and that's why it's so important. We talked about religion. We talked about government. We talked about research. You hear a lot in Latin communities, they love to use the phrase machismo. The reason why I'm asking the question is because Oliver brought up top and bottom, which essentially means in anal sex, the top or activo.
Activo, pasivo.
And pasivo. Activo is going to be with anal sex. The person that is the insertive partner, putting their penis in someone's anus. The receptive partner is going to be the one who's receiving. Behaviors tie a lot into the concept of machismo. Can you talk a little bit about that and how machismo wraps into this HIV conversation?
When we were talking about the religion piece, because I actually think that these things come together, that my sister actually told me that if you are gay, you will get HIV and die. And I thought that my own family had cursed me because I was queer and then I got diagnosed. And machismo isn't just about men, cis men, controlling the conversation. It is about how we interact with each other and the lack of empathy that we have for each other. And it comes from a lack of models of masculinity that actually teach us to express empathy for each other.
And how does that impact HIV rates in Latin communities?
When we're scared to not fit into that image of what a man is, then we're not going to have those conversations that Oliver was just saying, right? We're not going to talk to each other about the vulnerabilities that we have.
I also wanted to add something to what Jose was saying around machismo. And it's that also it comes tied to the patriarchy, that comes tied to the church, also that comes, you know, to all these beliefs that they tell women, or you need to obey the man of the house. So like a lot of these women that get no infections, it's because they put their health in their husband's hands. If you're putting your own health, if you don't take charge of your own health and you're just like, okay, well, my husband knows better. If he tells me not to take PrEP because he's not fooling around, I have to believe him because that's what the pastor said, or that's what society says. And then suddenly you're sick, you don't know what happened, and you got HIV, you don't know how you got it. So now you got like a double trauma on your hand. First of all, they cheated on you, but now you also got a deadly disease from the person that you're supposed to trust the most. These machista communities don't want people to learn in school about sexual education because, oh no, now women are getting empowered. We don't have our position of power anymore to be able to like submit you and tell you that what we say is right. So machismo also comes like in the form of like psychological oppression to women and also like minorities.
How does the social and political environment begin to impact your work?
So I work with heterosexual couples that are looking to get on PrEP. And in those situations, many of the women that are cis and heterosexual that are actually trying to potentially get on PrEP will say, I have had the experience before where I have condoms or different STD medications available, and my partner will actually hit me, right? Because I have these, because he's saying that I'm sleeping around, right? That's where the violence comes in. That actually has not to do with the HIV. It has to do with the stigma, with the culture.
That's a huge point because we're at an inflection globally where we have the medications, we have the tools to actually eradicate this pandemic, epidemic, whatever you want to call it. Where the work really needs to be done is on the social level. And what you're speaking to, Jose, is exactly along those lines.
How is that work happening? Like, what does good look like?
Well, definitely, like Jose said, well, HIV is a cured disease, I would say also, because if everybody would know like, that they are HIV positive and would get tested and get like the retrovirals, then U equals U, we wouldn't be passing it on to everyone else. Right now, I'm working with a great program in Colombia, again, in Panama, for all the migrants that are coming through Ecuador, then they start walking towards the United States. So what it looks like is the education at migration ports, at refugee ports, in low-income society, in low-income neighborhoods around all these Latin American countries or around the world. But mostly, I would say also like health clinics available to not only women and gay and heterosexual men. But I always use this great example where the first time I encountered an LGBT center or LGBT clinic was in Australia. This is not a thing in Latin America. What good looks like is not denying that this exists, not denying that we exist.
But the question to you, Jose, same thing. What does good look like? What are the solutions that we need to do? Particularly for Latin communities to address this HIV epidemic.
In the United States, that HIV is heavily criminalized. And so good looks like HIV not being a crime. It means like decriminalizing sex in the United States and creating those kinds of community spaces, using those funds that are getting used to police our community and actually diverting them to build those spaces so that we can come together and have honest and hard conversations, right? And be vulnerable with each other. One of my proudest moments in this work was starting the first LGBTQIA+ Latina Southern Conference called an Encuentro, which is a word that means coming together. It means gathering of your people. So it looks like being able to understand each other because, like I always say, politics, just like sex, is better when you actually know what the other person's saying.
You speak about coalition building. Tell me, why is that important to this work?
Because we need to be able to build a world where all of us are able to get what we need. There are certain conversations that I can only have with other PAS Latina people, right? Because they're going to know what it feels like, right? To be in those dark moments. What we're doing here actually offers lessons to other movements, other communities, right? And just seeing us as the solution, as something that we have something to offer.
So Jose, what are some of the biggest challenges that Latinx people living in the United States face when it comes to engaging in HIV care?
So much of my work has been in the southern United States, which is an area where HIV continues to be heavily criminalized. And so the Latinx community, Latina community, faces stigma out of fear of deportation. I have worked with many immigrant couples where after they have split up, if they are both undocumented and one of them is living with HIV, the partner might get mad at them and then will call the police on them and then they will get put into deportation proceedings. Hospitals are closing. And those hospitals that are there often don't have providers who are trained to be responsive to the Latina community or who can speak in Spanish or who have interpreters and translators on staff. I have several photos that I can show of different clinics putting out messages saying, if you don't have your own interpreter and translator, then you're not going to be able to get your own care and you're basically just out of luck.
What should medical facilities, hospitals, clinics be doing better instead of putting those kind of signs that deter people? What could they do better?
To be compliant with federal law, they actually have to have interpreters and translators, so they should just be doing what they're legally obligated to do. But I would also say having more signs, having more staff who are multilingual, and even better if they're multilingual and living with HIV.
it raises a question for me, and I actually will go to both of you here. We'll start with you, Oliver. Are you seeing any progress in Latin America with all that has happened?
Yes, there are like four big aid programs. And this is the other thing also with language, that in Latin America, people don't distinguish HIV from AIDS. So people don't really understand, oh my God, I got HIV. They immediately think that they have AIDS.
We've had that same issue here in the United States as well. It's kind of one of those things where we're still focusing on AIDS as a disease.
Yeah.
AIDS.gov was recently changed to HIV.gov. And so those things are happening, I think, on a global level.
Well, in the United States, too, if you are ever diagnosed with AIDS, you actually will keep that diagnosis on your record permanently. There's no way to get it off. On the global side, I mean, particularly just like working in with folks in Mexico and across there, I'm more on the community organizing level. And for me, it's just been so amazing to see folks, particularly like in Mexico City, organizing like sex positive photo shoots of people living with HIV and throwing our own kink parties and practicing sex positivity. So folks are doing the work, right? And that's always where I want to go, right? What are we doing to actually change and build that future that we want? And I know that it's happening, right? Even if, you know, in most countries, the federal level is always lagging behind.
Well, in public policy, if you see Latin America, like Argentina, they're like their program was called HIV Ends With Me. And they had a reduction in newly infected rates. In Peru, they had the condomaton, where they showed teenagers how to wear condoms. Mexico has a great program with their foreign affairs. Like at all Mexican embassies, I've never seen this in another embassy, have their own LGBTI specific like points where you go to any Mexican embassy and they will have a person that is like ready to attend the LGBTIQ people and like connect them to either medical resources or connect them into like the local, you know, LGBTIQ center. So it's very Miami, especially. I've only seen Miami and Houston, but they told me this is in every Mexican embassy worldwide. So that's another great public policy program. To get rid of the stigma and include these migrant societies into the, oh, it's no problem if, you know, you have HIV, because once you understand that you're not, you can be non-infectious and that you can live a long, healthy life, the trauma starts to also like wane away and you can recuperate.
One last question. What does ending the HIV epidemic look like for you?
For me, definitely getting everyone tested. So what the ending the HIV pandemic looks like is, first of all, taking care of your own health. Don't put your health in someone else's hands. You need to be taking care of what you think is right. Take care of yourself. Second, get tested, because that's the best, you know, arms that we have into somehow confront this pandemic. And once you get tested, also, you know, start taking your medication.
Before you get to what the HIV epidemic ending it looks like for you, can you talk about the word infected and what that means with regards to stigma, HIV, et cetera, et cetera, since language is a part of this conversation today?
Ending the HIV epidemic to me looks like people living with HIV being the solution and developing language in a broad way that helps us achieve empathy and equity, right? Being able to actually develop language that practices empathy with each other. And I think that just means reminding ourselves that the first letter in HIV is human. It's H, human, right? So finding our humanity and whatever helps us find that wherever we are.
What a pleasure this has been to have you both share your experiences. It's been enlightening, really. Just thank you both. When it comes to HIV, stigma and discrimination knows no boundaries. But unfortunately, our compassion so often starts and stops within the communities that we identify with. After today's conversation, it's clear that if we're going to end the epidemic, we must reach beyond borders, across languages, and across cultures. It's going to take all of us together if we're going to find an end to the epidemic. Subscribe to Zero Hour wherever you get your podcasts and look for it on YouTube. And for more information, please visit GileadHIVTogether.com. This presentation is protected by U.S. and international copyright laws and owned by Gilead Sciences. The podcast should not be copied, reproduced, or distributed in whole or in part without express permission from Gilead Sciences. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gilead Sciences.